This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Some interviews drive by, others stay for the deep record. This week I have two heavy hitters for you. Right out of the international news, forest fires near the Chernobyl nuclear wreck in Ukraine have raised dangerous radioactive particles into the atmosphere again. We have Dr. Timothy Musso, the world's foremost expert on the impacts of Chernobyl and Fukushima radiation on living things. This is Radio EcoShock. Let's get busy. The largest fire in 20 years is burning near the crippled Chernobyl nuclear plant. The smoke will re-release radioactive contamination dropped in the forests during the 1986 meltdown of reactor number 4, possibly the world's worst nuclear disaster. How can radiation remain and return? Scientists have been hard at work studying that problem. Just this February, the journal Ecological Monographs published a paper titled Fire Evolution in the Radioactive Forests of Ukraine and Belarus: Future Risks to the Population and the Environment. Dr. Timothy A. Musso is a co-author of that paper. Tim is a professor of biological sciences at the University of South Carolina. He joins us now. Dr. Musso, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
How long have you been studying the biological after effects of Chernobyl radiation?
Well, we first got started in Chernobyl in the summer of 2000, actually, and we've been visiting the site four times every year since.
All right. Now, we've been told nature has returned to the closed zone around the plant and everything is thriving. Is that true?
Well, like so many of these statements, it's part true and part false. It is true that nature has come back to some extent, and certainly there are plants and animals living in the areas around the nuclear reactor. There are even some living in the most contaminated parts of the exclusion zone. But what the real question should be is there an impact of the radioactivity of these animals that and plants that are living in this area? And that's really the question that we've tried to focus on for the past 15 years or so.
Now, what general areas did the radiation settle in as far as forests are concerned?
Well, you know, the fire, you know, it was a nuclear fire that burned for 10 days, and it was basically, you can liken it to a volcano emitting these radioactive isotopes into the atmosphere. And so depending on which way the wind was blowing and whether it was raining or not, the fallout dropped all over the area. The highest, you know, the areas of highest contamination are within a couple hundred kilometers of the actual reactor, but it actually was dispersed across Scandinavia and as well as into Central and Western Europe. And, of course, it's detectable around the Northern Hemisphere. If you take a core from the ocean anywhere just about in the Northern Hemisphere, you'll find traces of the Chernobyl event in the sediments that were deposited. So it really had a nearly global impact in terms of the dispersion of the radioactivity. But the highest levels are found within 50 to a couple hundred kilometers of the actual reactor.
And how does this work? Does radiation just stay in the soil, or do the trees and other plants take it up into their parts?
Yeah, well, you know, the dominant isotope in Chernobyl and Fukushima, for that matter, is cesium-137. And cesium-137 is, you know, a potassium analog. It behaves chemically much like potassium does. And so the plants actually confuse it for potassium and take it up as if they were taking up potassium. So this potassium, cesium gets taken up by the plants in the water, transferred to the leaves and through the tissues, and so it gets moved around. Even though most of the fallout is in the soil, it gets taken up in the water through the plant root system up into the leaves, and then redeposited onto the surface soil every year as the plants, you know, drop their leaves, usually during the fall.
How serious are the fires now near Chernobyl at the end of April 2015?
So it, it, luckily, it sounds like they've got the fires under control. But clearly, the estimates are from a few hundred acres to a few thousand acres of forest have been burned. Some of these fires are in areas of relatively high contamination. Luckily, much of the area burned is just happens by chance to be in an area that has relatively low contamination. So hopefully they've managed to put it out before it got to the hottest areas where the greatest hazards would be from the redispersal of the radionuclides.
Have there been fires in the neighboring country of Belarus, and is that important?
There have been fires throughout the area. In fact, we were just looking at a recent satellite photo showing that there have been many dozens of fires, most of them quite small, throughout Ukraine and Belarus and parts of southwestern Russia as well. And all of these areas have significant land mass contaminated by Chernobyl, and as such are potentially hazardous with respect to forest fires redispersing the contaminants. So it's an ongoing condition. It's likely to get worse in the future as global climate change raises the average temperatures and reduces the total amount of precipitation in the area as well.
And you were part of a team of scientists, Timothy Musso, who studied exactly this risk. What did you conclude?
Yeah, the team is a large team, a multinational team from many countries who got together to examine the past records of forest fires and to make use of what we know of the original incident where the radionuclides were dispersed from the reactor as it melted down, put those two together, combine it with the current trends in climate change, increasing temperatures and precipitation patterns, and reduced precipitation in many of these areas, put that all together into a simulation model. And what we basically demonstrate is that there's an enormous potential hazard from these forest fires because of the fact that they're likely to increase in size and intensity, and this has the power to lift the radioactive contaminants from the soil, from the plant material, and put it into the atmosphere and redistribute it.
Now, what kind of radiation are we talking about? Are there other elements and isotopes beyond cesium-137 that get out in that fire smoke?
Absolutely. And the current concern is, of course, that several of these other isotopes are potentially far more dangerous biologically than the cesium-137. We tend to focus on the cesium because it's easy to measure. We can measure it with a gamma counter, with a simple Geiger counter, in fact, whereas some of the other isotopes, like strontium-90, which is really there at about equal levels to the cesium, the strontium-90, because it's a beta emitter, it doesn't give off any gamma. This makes it much, much harder to measure its levels, and so people tend not to bother to measure it and simply to assume that it's going to move along with the cesium. But the strontium is a calcium analog, and so it gets taken up the same way into plants and animals the way that the calcium would, and as a consequence, it tends to be fixed into the teeth and into the bones, and it can actually bioaccumulate and biomagnify up the food chain to a much greater level than cesium usually does. So this makes it even a more hazardous isotope. It tends to, again, be in the background because we can't measure it very easily. There are other isotopes. There's a significant amount of plutonium in the ground deposited around the reactor. This plutonium is also decaying into something called americium. And americium and plutonium are extremely dangerous if ingested. The dangers are well known and never a threat. They're heavier, they're denser, and they're less likely to be mobilized, but they are going to be mobilized if the fire is large enough. And, of course, the half-lives for the plutonium isotopes are measured in the tens of thousands of years for the most part, and the americium is in hundreds of years. So, in fact, the americium levels are increasing in the area as a result of the decay of the plutonium. And so, the hazards are actually going to increase over the coming decades with respect to those isotopes.
And I'm presuming there are health risks to humans who would breathe this forest fire smoke?
Absolutely, and the biggest risks, the biggest hazards are for the firefighters who have to go in and put these fires out as quickly as they can. There's really no way, you know, for them to protect themselves from much of the exposure. They do wear masks and gloves, and so hopefully that minimizes their exposure. But just being there, breathing that air, means that they're going to be getting a significant dose as a result. Luckily, the further away you are from the source, the more diluted the isotopes become, and the hazards related to direct exposure to humans decrease fairly quickly as you get further from these fires. But the problem is that it's not really the external dose that we're most concerned about in many cases. The cesium, for instance, gets taken up by plants differentially. Some and mushrooms, of course, are a major user of cesium in the soil. Again, they concentrate it to such an extent in their tissues that animals who feed on mushrooms, for instance, the wild boar and the mice and a few other things, they end up with levels of radioactivity inside their bodies that exceed safe levels for human consumption. Even in Germany, as far away as Germany, many of the wild boar cannot be eaten because of the high levels of cesium in their bodies. And we're of course presuming that some of the other isotopes are concentrated to a similar extent.
Now, what about the impacts on creatures like birds and insects? I think you've done some study on that. Could you take a little time and tell us what you and other scientists have learned?
Yeah, so we've been, we've been working with the birds primarily since 2000, Anders Moller and I together, and as well as many other individuals who've joined our team in subsequent years, and we've been finding all sorts of very unexpected consequences for the animals and plants living in these contaminated areas. The most striking findings we've reported in many different places over the years concern impacts on the abundance of various species. We found repeatedly for many species in both Chernobyl and Fukushima now that the numbers of birds drops off in the more contaminated areas. There's a really nice dose-response relationship, as it were, with many fewer of these birds in highly radioactive areas. We've subsequently, documented many potential mechanisms underlying these declines. Some of the more striking ones are the fact that in Chernobyl, at least, we see that up to 40% of the male birds are completely sterile. They have no sperm in the more radioactive areas. We see many other more subtle effects, like the fact that, again, birds in more contaminated areas have more higher incidences of cataracts, they have higher incidences of tumors and other developmental abnormalities that clearly would influence their ability to survive and reproduce. And of course, we're assuming that these are the underlying causal factors related to the population declines. In the last couple of years, we've started some new work with small rodents, mice and voles, both in Chernobyl and Fukushima, where we're trying to, repeat the studies that we've done in Chernobyl, and we're finding very similar patterns of decline and similar patterns of increased numbers of tumors and cataracts and other developmental abnormalities that are just rarely seen in sort of normal populations anywhere else.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Professor Tim Mousseau, an internationally recognized expert on the effect of radiation on living things. Tim, it's my understanding that some radiation is so long-lived it never goes away on a human timescale, let's say. Will radiation lifted by the current fires in the Ukraine just settle somewhere else to be a risk again and again?
Many of these elements, these radioactive isotopes, will eventually disappear. The half-life for cesium-137 is about 30 years, and for strontium-90 is about 29 years. And so certainly after a century or two, most of that will have decayed into either less radioactive or non-radioactive daughter products. But certainly we have, a century or two to deal with it. Some of the other isotopes I mentioned earlier, the plutonium isotopes and the americium, will be around for hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of years, just because they take much longer to decay into less dangerous daughter products. So it's an ongoing issue that's not going to disappear anytime soon. You know, I should mention that, you know, one of our primary interests and one of the, actually the main motivation for the research we've been doing in these areas wasn't so much to document, you know, all of these abnormal or these negative consequences of exposure to radioactivity, but in fact to determine whether or not there have been, you know, adaptive evolutionary responses of the organisms to this novel stressor. And so we've actually devoted some energy to understanding how populations might respond in a more positive way. And just recently, again, we published a paper last year demonstrating that, you know, a handful of birds, just a few of them, but a significant number, have actually managed to cope with the radiation in a way that was really quite striking. And they do this by changing the allocation of some of their antioxidants towards defense against the radiation. Now, it's not all rosy because this change in allocation probably incurs a cost in terms of, you know, they can't use that antioxidant for some other important function, but it certainly gives them an advantage when living in these radioactive areas. And that really is, you know, our hope is to better understand how these organisms respond and adjust and adapt and whether or not they can and what the underlying mechanisms are for that variability. Again, with the hope that such an understanding may help deal with, you know, the human populations or help address some of the problems that the human populations are facing in response to these contaminants as well.
That is fascinating and important work, I think. Now, as you know, Tim, the reactor site at Chernobyl is still not very safe. There's a temporary sarcophagus hastily thrown over it, and now part of a shell meant to confine further emissions is not completed almost 30 years after the meltdown. Why has it taken so long, and what is the holdup now?
Well, the main reason that it's taken so long is that it's incredibly expensive. It's you know, costing on the order of $2 billion to build this new shelter for the old reactor site. Without this new shelter, they really can't get started at a more permanent remediation of the area. They really need to dry it out and contain whatever dust and debris is contained inside the old reactor that you know could be released if the old shelter were to collapse in some way. But it's mainly a financial issue, as is often the case. $2 billion for a country like Ukraine is an enormous amount of money, and luckily the world community has stepped up to, you know, help fund the better part of this endeavor. Yeah, there's been recent meetings again to try to raise the remaining, you know, $500 million plus or minus that's needed to complete the project. Of course, that's just the beginning. That's just the first step in this process. Once they get this new roof in place, then they'll be able to hopefully develop ways to actually investigate the interior of the building, which has not been done to this point because it's so highly radioactive that, you know, people still cannot get into the lower reaches of the old reactor where most of the spent fuel has found itself. And so, of course, it's also a very wet area at the moment because the roof was leaking. Water has filled the bottom, and so this makes it impossible for people or machines to investigate you know, what's happened down there. So hopefully there will be ongoing investment by the international community to help solve this problem. But it does point to the sort of the broader inclusive costs of these kinds of disasters. You know, the disaster in Fukushima will end up being far more expensive because it's a much larger accident in many ways, and it's in a highly developed country. So, hopefully we'll make some progress in the coming years to solve these problems.
Tim, you are going right back to the Ukraine. Is it a bit chaotic there, and what will you be doing?
Yeah, things are very, very unstable at the moment in Ukraine, given the ongoing conflict between Ukraine and Russia over the eastern territories. And of course, this has had an enormous impact on their economy, and, you know, their currency has been devalued considerably by several factors in the past few years, certainly mostly the past few months, and the unemployment rates have gone through the roof, and so it's not a happy place to be visiting. We're hoping to continue our ongoing studies of the of the rodents living in the area, as well as studies of some of the other organisms like the endangered Chevalsky's horses that were introduced to the area that really haven't been monitored intensively since their introduction. So, yeah, the plan is to keep going, and we're also hoping to repeat some of our earlier surveys of distribution and abundance of many of the species later this year, probably in June.
Will you be continuing your research on the blown reactors in Fukushima, Japan, the impact on living things there as well?
Yeah, we have a parallel set of research studies going on in Japan at the moment, somewhat smaller scale because of lack of funding at the moment, but we're continuing to monitor the bird populations. We just published three papers in the past month or so documenting how the bird populations have been affected by the Fukushima disaster. The bottom line is that many of the bird species are showing very dramatic declines in the areas of high radioactivity. What makes that particularly interesting, of course, is that it parallels what we've been finding in Chernobyl in a completely independent area, again, providing fairly strong scientific support for the hypothesis that it's the radioactivity that's the underlying cause of these drops in numbers. So we're hoping to continue and repeat many of the Chernobyl studies in Japan, again, with the aim of determining whether or not we see the same kinds of patterns, which in all likelihood could only be explained by the radiation rather than any other potentially confounding factor.
Now, what about the contentious issue of the impact of low-level radiation? Every time there's a major accident, the nuclear industry says eating a banana or flying in a plane is more dangerous. Is low-level radiation dangerous?
So, you know, the bottom line to all this discussion is that all radiation of all sorts generates damage to our cellular structures. It leads to damage to our DNA, damage to the membranes around the nucleus of our cells and the cell walls themselves. Our bodies have evolved mechanisms to repair most of this damage over the eons. Radiation isn't new. Mutagens in the environment aren't new. And in fact, the very oxygen we breathe is a major cause of mutations in our bodies. And so we have all the machinery in place to deal with it, at least to some extent. But the fact that we grow old and die is actually in part the product of ongoing mutational accumulation through our lives. So radiation of all sorts, even small amounts, contributes to that. And so there's no such thing as a little bit of radiation being good for you. It may not be detectable in its effects because it's small relative to the other mutagens in our environment. But the more you add, the more the effects will be. And that's really what's going on. So, you know, one airplane ride is unlikely to be of much significance given that we expose ourselves to many other mutagens in the environment. The same could be said for, you know, eating one banana. But if you fly an awful lot, then you will be increasing the dose to your body. And this has been demonstrated to lead to increased rates of cataracts, for instance, in airline crews, which is one of the first signs of radiation exposure. We see it in the birds. We see it in humans as well. And certainly, it's just the first step. There are other consequences likely. We also did a study not too long ago, a survey of the literature and a meta-analysis of other people's data, in addition to our own, of human and plants and animals living in naturally radioactive areas of the world. You know, there are many parts of the world that have relatively high levels of natural radioactivity stemming from the uranium and thorium that's in the soil. Some parts of the world is very close to the surface, and this leads to extra radiation to the populations living there. And of course, you know, medical science has known for a long time that, you know, the second leading cause of lung cancer in the U.S. and in China is from the radon in the ground, which is, again, a natural source of radioactivity. It leads to many thousands of extra deaths due to lung cancer in the U.S. every year because of this additional radiation source. But when you look at all the other animals for other kinds of characters in these naturally hot spots, many of them show consequences in terms of either genetic damage or other kinds of diseases as a direct consequence of the exposure to these very low levels in these naturally hot spots. So, yeah, this whole notion that a little bit of radioactivity extra radioactivity. You shouldn't worry about this. Again, it's all dependent upon how much little extra radioactivity. There's no such thing as extra mutagens being good for you.
Now, we've talked about the risk of forest fires in the Ukraine and its neighboring countries. What about the risk of forest fires in Japan after the Fukushima nuclear accident?
Well, that's one of the first things that comes to mind. We've been thinking a little bit about that. It's a different kind of environment. It's a more humid environment, and it's mostly montane. And so I really don't know what the potential fire hazards are in that environment currently. It's always a concern, especially where you've had years and years of forest management largely restricting fire from occurring. And so this leads to the accumulation of fuel on the surface layer that can be sparked by a bolt of lightning or a cigarette by a passerby, as seems to have been the case in Chernobyl this past week. And that can generate these very large fires. So, yes, it is a significant concern for Japan, although I don't think anybody's really started to think about it just yet. But given what we found with respect to the accumulation of dead plant material in more radioactive areas, the fact that the radiation impedes the normal decomposition process, leading to higher accumulation of what is essentially fuel for a fire, this is a significant concern. We've just started experiments this past year in conjunction with some of our Japanese colleagues to see whether or not the same kind of accumulation of litter is happening in Japan in the more radioactive areas, and hopefully we'll have an answer to that by this fall.
Now, as we wrap up, is there anything that I've missed that you would like to leave with our listeners?
There's so much I could go into. So there are a couple of issues, broader issues, that are worth pointing out. And the first is that because of differing perspectives by different communities related to this topic, and by that I mean scientific and policy-making communities, there's really been very little investment into the sorts of basic research that our group has been doing, the basic ecology, genetics, and evolutionary biology that really has a large impact on the natural communities. So it's been largely ignored. And the second is that these nuclear accidents are not as rare as we used to think they were. There was a recent study published, highlighted by MIT, that suggested that nuclear accidents on the scale of Chernobyl are likely to occur in the coming years. You know, a 3-mile island scale accident is likely to occur in the next 10 years. You know, nuclear energy is not going away anytime soon, and so we really do need to know more, much more, about the potential consequences for both human health and the broader environmental impacts if we're going to continue down this path.
That's a great point. You know, after Chernobyl, we thought, well, that's it. We've learned it'll never happen again, and now we have Fukushima, and there have been a lot of near misses in between. We've been talking with one of the most experienced scientists studying the impacts of radiation on living things. He's published over 160 papers, 2 books, and co-edits the annual work, The Year in Evolutionary Biology. Dr. Timothy Mousseau is a professor of biological sciences at the University of South Carolina. You can find links to his work and some of his interviews and presentations in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.info. Tim, thank you for your continuing work and for talking with us today.
A pleasure.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.